Hey, watchers. My name's Kevin Strange.
My name's Jeremy Daniels.
And we're from the Reading to Strangers podcast, where you can hear serialized stories and books from the Kevin Strange fiction catalog each and every week, right, Jeremy?
Oh, I thought it was the podcast to watch Kevin Strange burn his career down, but I guess I'm wrong.
I mean, that's basically what it is. So come subscribe to us on iTunes, Stitcher, and where all other podcasts are found there, gang. Reading to Strangers.
Inconceivable!
Hey, welcome back to Watching with Strangers. My name is Kevin Strange.
This is Travis.
And we actually tried to do this show just a minute ago, and we got so wrapped up in our discussion of what we've been watching and sort of the history of digital media that we ended up doing a whole half hour on it. We didn't want this show to be that long, so we, you know, because we literally didn't even mention the name of the movie we're doing this week. So we ended up calling that the Patreon episode. So if you're interested in what we've been watching this week, you want to catch up, you're interested in the history of digital media, you throw us $1 a month, you get to listen to our bonus Patreon episodes. Not a lot to ask for. $12 a year. That's like three monsters.
Yep, we fit all kinds of good little snippets in there for
it. It's like three monster drinks.
Right.
For a whole year of bonus content. So, what are we here to watch this week, Travis?
We are diving into The Princess Bride.
One of my favorite movies of all time.
682.
No, for real though. This movie is so good that I feel like if there haven't already been books written about it, I could write an entire book about the brilliance of this movie.
It's so much fun.
Okay, there's maybe two movies that I think are perfect on this planet. Or three movies that I think are perfect on this planet.
That's it, really?
Perfect movies that I don't think there's a second of wasted time or something falls flat or something's edited weird or I don't like the music. None of it. Mm-hmm. And that is The Thing from John Carpenter, Texas Chainsaw Massacre 2 from Tobe Hooper, and this motherfucker. Princess Bride by Rob Reiner.
The bold statement, my friend.
I don't think there is a moment in this film that's wasted. And as far as those three movies go, I believe this is a perfect script. As far as the writing goes, the writing of this film is so good. Well, I dare you to find a point in this script that isn't genius level.
Well, and that's inevitable. I mean, when you have William Goldman, who wrote the book that it's based on, and then he also was given sole ownership of writing the screenplay as well. I mean, that says a lot.
I mean, and I haven't read this book, but my God, what great witty writing. This movie, The Princess Bride, was released in 1987. Mm-hmm. It was released on October 9th, 1987, in wide release.
Right, which is an odd time of year to release a movie like this.
Yeah, the movies that came out at the same time, I have it written down here, don't I? I thought I wrote down the... no, I don't. I didn't write down the weekly. I wrote down some other aspects, but I didn't write down the weekly gross. Anyway, it was made for $16 million, and to date has only made $30
million. A little over $30 million. So,
now, I was going to say this was another cheater episode, because the people who made this film, from the director to the writer to everybody involved in this project, to the actors, these are all A-listers.
For the most part, yeah.
So this is a cult film. Again, we kind of did this with RoboCop, where this is an Academy Award nominated film, and it involves some huge heavy hitters in Hollywood, and yet, when I looked up release date for Princess Bride, you know what the first thing I found was?
What?
Midnight screenings.
Yep. And even though it doubled its budget, you gotta remember, as the key kind of general rule, you double the budget to cover your marketing. So really, this movie initially was not a box office success. It wasn't until the film hit home video that it really started to find its stride and get its popularity growing.
Now, it did open at number 3 for the week. Mm-hmm. It opened with $4.4 million. But a movie that opens at $4.4 million today mm-hmm. is considered a bona fide flop.
Right.
$4.4 million is impossible. But, you know, mm-hmm. that's adjusted for inflation and all blah, this blah, blah, stuff. Right? I don't know where it would actually fall.
All this economic jargon.
Anyway, it was 14% of the gross mm-hmm. of that week's films. And I don't know why I don't have the other films that opened that week. Did you write that down, or do you always leave that for me?
No, I usually count on your...
Well, I wrote down stuff like it's 14% of the gross for the week, but I did not get the actual films that it opened with. However, it was a 1987 release, so there are some films we've already talked about. RoboCop right. was a 1987 film. What was the second movie we did?
Monster Squad.
Monster Squad was a 1987 film, and Chopping Mall was a 1986 film. There's a reason, gang, that the majority of the movies we've done on this, that we've reviewed on this podcast so far, have been 86 and 87. These movies are the 80s movies and early 90s, late 80s, early movies.
Ooh. Okay, you want me to give you a handful of the movies that opened alongside Princess Bride?
Yeah.
Now, this is going to just prove my point. This seems like a really odd, especially in the 80s. Keep in mind, it's not like this today. Yeah. October for new movies today is not like it used to be and not the way it should be, in my opinion. But in the 80s, totally different ballpark. So, October 9th, 1987,
I'm going to guess you had a Nightmare on Elm Street.
Well, no, just hold on. You had Hamburger Hill.
Okay.
Okay, great war film.
Yep.
Fatal Attraction. Okay. Pretty darn good sexy thriller. Okay. Hellraiser.
Oh.
Ooh. And Near Dark.
Okay.
Which
wow.
may or may not in the future become an episode on this Watching
wow,
Strangers. Wow,
you got Near Dark, Hellraiser, and The Princess Bride in the same week. This is why right. I say 86 and 87 were such yep. monster years for movies.
That's crazy.
Let me tell you a couple other things. So this movie was nominated for music.
Original song.
Original song, Storybook of Love.
Mm-hmm. By?
I didn't write that down.
Mark Knopfler, and this is why I bring this up. Mark Knopfler is the founder of Dire Straits.
Oh, okay.
And he single-handedly is a big part of this movie being as successful as it is. Because when you think about the music in this movie...
I was going to mention that, yeah.
Oh, my God. We're jumping the gun a little, but it's like the music is a third...
It's a character.
It's a character in the movie, yeah.
I mean, and there, so, are you there are beats Martin in the movie yeah. where the action of the film mm-hmm. and the music are key, just in sync.
Right. But boom, just the boom, quirky, boom, boom. Romantic, offbeat kind of nature of oh, yeah. the film. I mean, it was okay. going to take a special very, kind of music to
very much
nail
it. Very much informed. Yeah. This is a film that's very much mm-hmm. informed by the music. Now, a lot of times, you would say that would be cheating. Like, if a film has to, or a show has to use... its score to make you feel an emotion, mm-hmm. then the characters and the writing aren't doing it for you. Mm-hmm. But there are rare moments where the characters are perfect. Yep. The writing is perfect. And instead of letting that hang mm-hmm. and having a reductionist type of mm-hmm. score, there are certain times where even then throwing that score in makes this weird mm-hmm. because you have to understand this is a storybook.
Right.
This is a fantasy. This Play isn't supposed
for
comedy. To be. This isn't supposed to be a reality based
right.
thing. So adding that music to it, mm-hmm. there's really no point in this movie where you ever feel like these things are really happening.
Right.
This is absurd. And that's another thing that plays into this film that makes it work so well. Mm-hmm. The wittiness of the writing, mm-hmm. the fact that every, and we'll get into this in a second, every single actor in the film is a character actor.
Yeah, and their comedic chops are so on cue.
That's why they're so good, because they're all, right. it's a goddamn whole film full of character right. actors.
Yep.
But then it's that, so what did I say? I said the
music.
I said the music. The writing, and then
the acting.
Yeah, the acting is...
I mean, nothing against the cinematography. It's a perfectly wonderful-looking film, and it's pretty and everything, but it's not about the visuals. The visuals are fine. They're successful. They're well done. But at no point in this movie do you watch it and say, man, that movie was beautiful to look at. No, because you're too busy laughing your ass
it's
off.
It's so witty, man. It's witty. Yeah. It's quirky. And memorable. It's so well acted by these absolute A-list character actors. This is what 1987 was. Mm-hmm. These were the other nominated films for best score. This is just best music.
Right.
You had a song from Beverly Hills Cop 2. You had a song from Dirty Dancing. You had a song from Mannequin. You remember Mannequin?
Yeah, how can you not? Cheesy ass.
Probably belongs somewhere on this list.
Yeah.
And Cry Freedom, whatever that was.
Yeah, I vaguely remember it.
And Dirty Dancing ended up winning, obviously.
Yeah, that was obviously a popularity contest.
But that's a great
movie. But that screams 80s for that to be the nominee.
That's a great movie. Let's not shit on Dirty Dancing. Don't put baby in a corner. Is one of the most iconic lines. Patrick Swayze was bona fide wank material for teenage those girls in the
1980s. Classic pre-nose job Jennifer Grey.
Yeah. She ended up getting a nose job because people made fun of her from this
poor
movie.
Thing.
She didn't need one. She looked great. I have a thing for weird noses.
Oh, she started in a movie called Dirty Dancing.
I have a thing for girls with weird noses.
Oh, yeah?
I don't know if you know that or not.
There, this just in.
I like an interesting look. I don't like perfect symmetry on a
I'm not in a cookie cutter eater.
Give me something weird. Give me some big eyebrows or some eyes.
Something weird.
I especially like weird noses, though. Okay. There's a lot of weird noses in this world.
Yeah.
Noses get made.
You really liked
noses get
you really
made.
Liked the movie The Witches, didn't you? That's a lot of weird noses.
Is that on our
movie
list?
It needs to be.
If that's not on our list, that needs to be. That movie's crazy. Let's have the most terrifying kids movie. Like a transformation. Right. Where they're like degloving the flesh off
add
their
that
arms
to movies and of add that to great kids movies that are terribly creepy, like the Ernest Scared Stupid Troll, you know.
Yeah. So I guess let's dig into it. This movie was directed by Rob Reiner.
Mm-hmm.
For those who don't know, Rob Reiner is one of Hollywood's
Golden
most
Boys.
Prolific, mm-hmm. but well earned.
Oh yeah,
he's not a Golden Boy because of somebody he knows. He's a Golden Boy because he is anything. When you say Golden Boy, literally everything he touches is gold. This guy, let's just tell where did Mr. Reiner first become famous?
Well, Rob Reiner he comes from sort of a Hollywood family. So his dad, Carl Reiner, was a comedian, vaudeville, and got into the movies business. But Rob didn't just ride that. Rob actually made a name for himself. So probably if people first got to know Rob, and again,
when you say got to know, world famous.
Right.
World famous.
Well, now come on, Kevin. Let's cut to the chase. Let's stop pussyfooting around and let's just turn this up to 11, okay? The world first really got a taste of Rob Reiner with This Is Spinal Tap.
They first got a taste of Rob Reiner as Meathead from All in the Family.
Well, yeah. I mean, as an actor, you're right. Okay,
that's what I mean.
I was going straight to director, but yeah.
World famous actor from the 1970s television show.
Oh, that classic
All in the
politically
Family.
Correct show you're talking about.
And we're talking, he was the second most popular character on the show? Didn't they end up doing a spinoff?
I think they tried.
And it failed, but it was him, right? Him and his wife had a spinoff. And then this motherfucker decided, tell me he didn't have retire young money from that role.
Right.
From playing Meathead. Everybody knew who he was.
The show was huge.
Instead of that, he decides to direct one of the most classic, probably the number one most
classic. It started a whole subgenre of film.
Called mockumentaries.
Right.
This is still to this day the pinnacle of mockumentaries. So when you said turn it up to 11, because you're talking about this film.
This is Spinal Tap. Where, it's a quote from the movie, where basically the dial on the amps go to 10. Well, they have a specially made amp that goes to 11.
It's
become a cultural phrase.
For today's kids, if you're listening to this, it's Metalocalypse before there was Metalocalypse. Right. It was this idea of the completely out-of-touch, mega-famous rock star. They just can't... And it's Rob Reiner's pretending to
document this tour.
This metal band, this hair metal band,
right,
that's so out-of-touch with reality, they can't... figure, you know, they don't know their fucking head from a hole in the ground, their asshole from a hole in the ground, but it's all fake.
Right. And we always like to dive into the connections when we have them here on Watching with Strangers.
Walking with Strangers?
Walking with Strangers. Yeah, that's our sister podcast coming up where you can get your cardio walking fitness while listening to strangers talk about movies. That's our podcast on the go. But no, this movie also really kind of introduced us to and gave a start to one of my favorite royal figures turned Hollywood geniuses, Christopher Guest, who, to my knowledge, he's like a lord in England or something like that. I don't know. I don't care about all the royalty stuff, but I mean, and he married Jamie Lee Curtis, which made me jealous for a while. And, but Christopher Guest took that idea that Rob Reiner started with the mockumentary and he just ran with it for a while. And he gave us movies such as like Best in Show, A Mighty Wind, Waiting for Guffman. These are brilliant mockumentaries of absurdity on the level of like Waiting for Godot, but as comedy films, and they've A-list improv casts, seasoned improv actors, young and old. And if you haven't heard of him or his movies, check them out. But Christopher Guest then is also in this movie.
Yeah,
but we're talking about today. But we're not going there yet.
I haven't stopped sucking Rob Reiner's dick yet. Let's just get through him real
back,
quick.
Back then, yeah.
So past This Is Spinal Tap, he also directed When Harry Met Sally, which is weird because he directed When Harry Met Sally after he did this movie, where Billy Crystal has one of the most obnoxious...
One of the best scenes in the movie.
One of the most obnoxious, like, Jewish stereotype cameos. And somehow he went from, oh... this little troll of a man is so weird and quirky. I'm going to put him as the romantic lead of my next film, When Harry Met Sally. But that's a classic 80s film. He also did Stand By Me.
Yep.
One of my favorite movies of all time.
Classic Stephen King adaptation.
Another adaptation,
which is one of my, probably my favorite Stephen King adaptation, is Misery.
Mm-hmm.
And he directed that. You just look at these films alone that we've talked about. And look at the diversity and the range.
There's more Stephen King to come, too, by the way, as we get through this list here. Do you guys like this? Because we usually spend like 30 or 45 minutes of this show telling you about all the people, the connections, what they did before the movie.
Let us know.
The kind of stuff that I'm passionate about and Travis is passionate about. But if you want us to go back to like what we did in episode one where we just like recap the entire film, like by the time we're 45 minutes into this and we've just been talking about the people involved, I don't want to go another hour just blow by blow recapping the movie. So let us know which you like better, because we can skip all this if you want, but this is one of the cool things about being movie fans, is making all these connections, these Hollywood connections and actor connections and stuff, all the different things. Like, I love watching a movie from a director and then realizing that he's directed 20 other things, and some of which I've never seen, and because the directors bring a particular style, the writers bring a particular style, the people who do the scores and the music, they bring a style, and so you can follow that across multiple films, and I think that's part of what makes us film dorks so passionate about this. So moving on, he also directed A Few Good Men. A Few Good Men was written by who I consider to be... So if I consider The Princess Bride, William Goldman's script for The Princess Bride to be the best script ever written, A Few Good Men was written by Aaron Sorkin, who I consider to be the best screenwriter.
Master with dialogue.
So Rob Reiner has worked with two absolute master writers. And I applaud him for being able to take these master writers and being able to take their material and turn it into... Because I think, didn't A Few Good Men win Oscars?
I think it won some Oscar love, yeah.
So,
I remember the specifics.
So this dude's a bad motherfucker, basically. Yeah. You have anything else to add about Rob Reiner before we move on?
No, I think we successfully stroked his ego quite a bit. So moving on from there, I mean, we talked briefly about William Goldman. He's got lots of writing credits. He wrote the novel as well as the screenplay for this movie. To give you a sample of the caliber of writing, both in terms of movies and just writing in general, William Goldman also wrote both the book or the novel and the screenplay adaptation of his own book for Marathon Man, starring Dustin Hoffman, from the 70s, I think it was, or early 80s.
Yeah.
A great little sci-fi piece. And one of my favorite... crime drama films, Heat, starring De Niro, Pacino. Bobby De Niro, and Al Pacino.
That was like their first
meeting.
So they were two, crime action movie madmen
exactly.
that got finally brought together.
And I tell you what.
Val Kilmer's also in that. We're going to be doing
before he got fat and crazy.
That took a long time. Come on, give him credit. Val Kilmer was in great movies.
Oh, Val Kilmer's the absolute best Doc Holliday ever.
Oh my God, yes. Including a movie that's in our top 10, Willow. He played Mad Mardigan from Willow.
But he, to give an example of the caliber, if you've not seen the brilliance of the writing in this, and then it was directed by Michael Mann, but we won't go into too deep into that, is for years I touted some of my best friends and my close circle of friends how good this movie was, and for years they made fun of me and just criticized me and just mocked me for loving this movie so much. And then as they got older and more mature, they went back and watched it, and one by one they came back to me saying, hat in their hand, saying, Travis, we're sorry. You're right. This movie's a fucking gem. And I just, you know, took it very modestly. But that's the caliber. Heat is such a good movie. I've seen. Yes, it's a long movie, but it's worth every second. And then just the screenplay, not based on his own material, but just writing the screenplay. William Goldman wrote All the President's Men, great political thriller, and a classic among Westerns, Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid. So that gives you an idea.
Wrote Misery.
Well, he wrote the, right. He adapted the screenplay for Misery. You're right, based on a Stephen King novel.
So that their repairing.
That illustrates for you why we talk so highly of William Goldman as a writer for this material. And of course, Princess Bride, he wrote the book and then adapted his own screenplay. But that's how tight and finely tuned this writing is.
You know what else he wrote? Hmm? He wrote Dreamcatcher.
Yeah, we won't mention that any further.
We are mentioning that because that's a Stephen King adaptation.
Watchers, you're going to find, I think, that this is one of the films that Kevin and I disagree on.
I wasn't about to say it was a good movie.
Oh, okay, good.
I was about to say it's amazing that he could write Misery and then write Dreamcatcher, but I think it's a testament to how bad of a book Dreamcatcher was.
Stephen King has even mentioned he was very, very reliant, shall we say, on opiates
during that period
when he wrote Dreamcatcher.
Correct me if I'm wrong, this was the first thing Stephen King wrote as the first novel he wrote after his accident, where he got hit by a van and nearly killed,
right.
Had to have a hip replaced, had to have all kinds of stuff, and he was like literally writing like a word
but keep in mind, going back even further, he wrote and directed Maximum Overdrive, and that was just purely recreational cocaine use, and he has admitted to that
there's a difference between cocaine and doing the other. It's one is
Dreamcatcher is cerebral shit.
Yeah.
Maximum Overdrive is just shit.
Maximum Overdrive is one of my favorite films of all time. And I hope we get to it on this podcast.
Oh, I'm sure we will.
So I thought that was weird that William Goldman is actually responsible for that, the screenplay for that travesty of a film. And I think, correct me if I'm wrong, you and me went to see that movie when it came out.
It's very possible.
I think we saw
both
that
walked out going, what the fuck?
Yeah, like, what the fuck did we just watch? Stars.
Real quick before we get into the stars, I just want to give a little love to a cinematographer. I don't know if you looked into that at all.
Nope.
I didn't recognize the name, but when I looked at the... you're going to kick yourself now. Because when I looked at his filmography, I realized the cinematographer's name is Adrian Biddle. This dude...
Yeah, I saw the name and it didn't...
This dude didn't for me either, but then I did my due diligence, and this dude deserves some props. James Cameron's Aliens...
Oh, wow! He shot Aliens?
Rob Reiner's Willow? Or not Rob Reiner's, but Willow?
He shot Willow? That's the other kid actor.
Yeah. the original Judge Dredd, which isn't a great film, but it looks awesome.
Yeah, with Stallone.
Event Horizon.
Oh, shit! He shot Event Horizon?
Yeah! And V for Vendetta was his final film he shot before he died.
Wow! So he shot some great
shit. This dude's
shit.
Got some awesome visual chops. So I wanted to give him much deserved credit.
Yeah, fuck me for leaving him out.
Fuck you, Kevin. Come on.
Those are some of my favorite films of all time.
Ding, ding, ding! I think we hit 700 now. All right, the cast.
Yeah.
Well, we got to start with how the film begins in terms of the cast, because growing up in the 80s. And we've talked about this before, and it'll probably come up over and over and over again. Fred Savage was like the poster boy for, or one of the poster boys, if not the poster boy, for being an adolescent boy in the 80s.
Absolutely, because of the Wonder Years.
Not only the Wonder Years, but quintessential kid movies of that age. I mean, he was in The Wizard. He was in...
Little Monsters.
Little Monsters, which I love on Big
Howie Mandel. One of my favorite movies of all time with Howie Mandel.
And there's a couple others I can't think of. But yeah, Wonder Years.
Look at the cover of this. Me and Jeremy from Reading to Strangers, we just did a
review of
Twisted's new record. And look how much they look like.
Very much influenced by Little Monsters.
Yeah, I said on that review podcast that they looked like they have very... you can't see this, of course, listening to the show, but Twisted had body paint done to make them look like blue demon monsters, and they look almost exactly like Howie Mandel looked in.
Now, I can't remember which one came out first. I want to say Little Monsters was first, but it's kind of like it was the boys' version of that type of movie, whereas Drop Dead Fred, which I think came out after, was more, and I loved them both.
You're still hitting the table.
Oh, yes. Drop
you brought it up. I would just let you keep hitting the table, but you're like, did you hear that there's like thumping?
I'm going to set up my hands now. Drop Dead Fred, I want to say came out after Little Monsters because it felt a little 90s. More
90s. It's a 90s.
And I love them both. They're both great films, but from my experience just talking to other film fans, Drop Dead Fred tends to women film fanatics tend to gravitate more towards Drop Dead Fred because your central character is a girl.
One of my ex-girlfriends.
Which was it? Phoebe Cates or Winona Ryder? I don't remember.
Phoebe Cates.
Okay. And whereas Little Monsters, your central character is Fred Savage. Mm-hmm. But they're both excellent films. Very much similar kind of movies. But I think it's such an interesting dynamic. And I think we have to do a comparison of the two.
Oh, that'd be really cool.
That'd be cool.
Yeah, one of my ex-girlfriend's favorite movies is Drop Dead Fred. So
guys always think of
Little Monsters
first. But yeah, Wonder Years, it was one of maybe two or three shows as a kid growing up that we watched as a family growing up every night when it was on. And it's just like, man, and even though it took place in the 60s and early 70s, it's like, man, I just drawn to it. It was so well done. I connected with it so much. And Fred Savage was central to that.
Oh, he's also the wheelchair kid in Silver Bullet.
Yeah, you're right. And then what's funny is he's a
another Stephen King. That's a Stephen King adaptation.
Stephen King Rose, man. I want that t-shirt, by the way. the thing is...
I didn't mean to throw you off.
No, it's all right.
Fred Savage.
Fred Savage.
Kid of the 80s.
Yeah, kid of the 80s.
Even though Wonder Years was set in the 60s and
70s. Yeah, I don't know where I was going with that now. Well, I know. Fred Savage is one of those rare examples of kid stars that had it big as a kid and then remained to be pretty successful as an adult, but not as an actor. He did some voiceover work here and there, but when I was researching, because I was thinking when I was watching this movie, after I watched the movie again, it's like, whatever happened to Fred Savage? Man, he's a TV directing fanatic. Well, he's directed a lot of TV.
Here's the thing about kid actors. Mm. Whenever people say all kid actors are fucked up, name one kid actor who's not fucked up. Well, first of all, the guy whose name we can't think of that directed Willow came from Happy Days.
Yeah.
What the fuck is his name?
Oh, Ron Howard.
Yeah. Ron Howard was a child actor.
He's the non-crazy of the brothers.
one of the most successful film directors of all time. He grew up just fine. Yeah. And Fred Savage. You don't hear anything about Fred Savage being crazy. And he was absolutely a child. One of the first things when you flip this movie on and it starts and Fred Savage is in bed. He's what?
Like
10?
10, maybe? 12 maybe.
Maybe. He's fucking young.
And he's got, and we got to, just like in Monster Squad, on his bed, he's got the old He-Man action figures, Master Universe. He's got an old Cheetos bag, and the
cars. I was looking around, I looked around.
What is that? There wasn't as much cool stuff.
He's one of those kids that I would have gotten along with okay, but not great because he had a lot of cars and sports stuff.
He was into his Tonkas and his Hot Wheels.
And I wasn't into cars and I wasn't into sports, but he did have He-Man figures.
But you know what he did have that makes me jealous? Cool as fuck grandpa. Because his grandpa Peter Falk, none other than the one and only Columbo. And that was a show, a lot of older people like their Matlock and their Magnum P.I. No, for me, it was Columbo all the way.
Yeah.
With the squinty eye and the cigar hanging out of his mouth and the trench coat. And he always left the bad guys thinking they won. And then you turns back around and says, oh, but wait, there's one more thing. And bam, he's got him. It's like, yes!
So he stays home from school. His grandpa shows up. There's a little bit of banter from mom, but mom doesn't last long. And it's indicative of the rest of this film. There are very few female characters in the film, and they really do absolutely nothing. But we'll get into that as the film centers around the actions of a woman. Yeah. She doesn't ever get to do anything. We'll get to that.
And we'll touch on her, because she's an interesting element.
Yeah. But mom just kind of comes and goes. Yeah. Grandpa comes in and says, hey, you're going to stay home from school? I'm going to read a book that my dad read to me. All in total Peter Falk.
I have a point something out that never occurred to me until I rewatched it earlier this weekend. He comes in and he has this book and he's like, hey, I thought I'd read you this book. Oh, no, he gives him a gift, and he doesn't. Neither of them have names in the movie, so we're just calling them Fred and Peter.
Yeah, Grandpa and Grandson.
Yeah. So Fred opens it and he says, it's a book. Like any kid would, what do you give me a book for? I'm sick. You make me sicker? You know? Yeah. And he's like, well, this is a book that my father used to read to me when I was sick, and I read to your father, and now I'm going to read to you. And this just this weekend we watched it, I paused there first, and I said, but wait a minute, where the fuck is this kid's dad?
Yeah,
it's very 80s.
Yeah,
it's not the 50s or 60s. Dads are around.
Yeah.
This kid's dad probably ran out on him,
or he's at work
24/7. Yeah. You know, those are the two options in the 80s. Yeah. But yeah, so here's granddad. He read it to his son. Yeah. Now he's got to read it to his grandson.
Yeah.
But yeah, so he's offering to read this book to Fred.
And the book is, of course, The Princess Bride.
The Princess Bride. Immediately, you know, this is a boy. He's thinking, oh, this sounds like crap, you know. But and then he starts reading it, and then that's when we get into the movie.
And we meet our two leads. Well, one of them is our leads; the other is kind of a prop for the entire film. But that's we'll get into that.
She's our female lead as much as you have one in this film.
So we have Carrie Ulz. Mm-hmm. How do you pronounce it?
I think I forget. I want to say it's Elwes.
Carrie Elwes.
But I think I'm wrong.
He plays Wesley / the Man in Black / the Dread Pirate Roberts, which we'll get into later. And also he was Wesley the
farm boy.
Yeah, the farm boy.
Right.
When we meet him. And we meet him and we meet Princess Buttercup, played by Robin Wright. And, you know, I watched Robin Wright.
Who is the namesake of the movie, the title character.
Yeah, the Princess Bride, right. Princess Buttercup. And I watch her all the time in the Netflix original series, House of Cards. And it took me, she's a beautiful woman now. She's a very striking woman.
Looking She's a at her, ball crusher in that movie, though.
Oh, yeah. Looking at her...
But what I mean is totally night and day different from how she portrays this character.
Yeah, in that show, she's very powerful. Very powerful woman. She's going to get things done. Even her president, Frank Underwood, her husband, President Frank Underwood, doesn't really know, where she lands, what her motives are. In this, she just plays the helpless damsel in distress.
Right.
But man, was she a beautiful... She's a beautiful, mature woman.
She's storybook beautiful in this movie.
Man, she's so pretty.
That's her goal for it. I mean, she's storybook, fairy tale, beautiful. Long blonde hair, the whole getup.
Let's go over some of Carrie. How did you say you pronounced it?
I want to say it's Elwes, but it's probably Ulz.
Carrie Elwes or Ulz, he is a motherfucker of a character actor.
I love the Errol Flynn pencil. Oh. And it's intentionally, because they don't do anything that's not intentionally. Slightly off-centered mustache like Errol Flynn had.
He is pitch perfect in this film. He also played characters in Glory.
Mm-hmm.
He played a character in Days of Thunder, mm-hmm. Hot Shots.
Don't forget the original Saw.
Bram Stoker's Dracula, I'm getting to that.
Okay.
Jungle Book, he had a voiceover in. He was a character in Twister. This movie,
Robin Hood Men in Tights.
This movie is, and I say this as kindly as humanly possible, but as usual, I'm going to come off as racist. But I think that's become a theme in this show.
You know what to expect now.
this movie is written so Jewy. This is one of the Jewy, isn't it? Doesn't it come off like a Mel Brooks? Like, the only thing it's lacking to be a Mel Brooks comedy is a line dancing, singing scene, right?
Yeah, there's no musical number.
I don't mean line dancing. You know what I mean. Like a Broadway, kick the legs up in the air,
Chorus line,
like a you know, like a Broadway musical style number, musical number in the film, and an appearance from Mel Brooks himself.
Right.
So what he went ahead and did was he starred as Robin Hood in the movie Robin Hood Men in Tights, where they went ahead and did musical numbers with Broadway leg kicking
and all that.
It was a Mel Brooks movie. This is as Jewy as a movie gets without going that. It doesn't break the fourth wall and look at the camera and yuck.
And again,
but it goes all the way up to that point and toes that line as tightly as you can before it goes over into that.
And line. I think Rob Reiner coming from a sort of a Hollywood vaudeville dynasty, he's kind of pulling from those familial roots where, you know, his dad came up in vaudeville. And very much that was the comedy of the time. And in a sense, he's either drawing from or maybe even paying a little homage to that. But it works. It's the key is, regardless of what you want to call it, it works. I mean, it just, the formula, they just nailed it.
Yeah, without going over and jumping into vaudeville musical territory.
It never becomes farcy. It never becomes a parody. It rides that line.
Right at that point.
So beautifully.
So witty. And so silly and absurd. It takes the absurdity of the vaudeville and it just dials it back one degree.
Right, but without losing the element of... And it is a fine line element of fantasy, of romance, and all these other things, even drama a little bit, that it just maintains that fine little hairline that fits nicely in the movie without ever tripping over it and falling too much into those subgenres, and remains at heart a comedy.
And then, of course, he was in the first Saw film.
Right.
And that's where modern film, you know, kids would mostly
probably
know him
from. Best friend.
But he was in a ton of stuff in the 80s and 90s. A ton of stuff. and then the supporting cast, my oh my, are they good. We very quickly, okay, so let's walk through the plot. And introduce the actors as we go.
Robert White, for anyone that may not have seen House of Cards that aren't really for sure who to connect her to, you best remember her as Jen A from Forrest Gump.
Yeah.
Okay, just to catch you up there a little bit.
So how do we want to go through the
supporting cast? Because this movie is like all I said, supporting cast.
Yeah, let's just walk through the film and then we'll talk about the supporting cast as we get there. So very quickly, Wesley goes off. Where's they ship him off somewhere?
Well, after he and Buttercup find out that they're in love and they're true love,
and that's the first time that Fred Savage goes, "Is this a kissing book?"
Right,
Grandpa,
exactly.
What do you read me?
Right, and he's busting Grandpa's chops because he's sick, and how could Grandpa dare come here and read him a kissing book? There's no sports in it. Come on, what's going on? Another parting point, I think, So basically, Buttercup is, I don't know if she's a princess at this point or just of wealth, but she's of some nobility. But, you know, Wesley, he's just a farm boy, a poor farm boy. He knows he doesn't have anything to offer her. And back in those days, to marry a woman of that caliber, you have to have something to show wealth, to offer. So he decides he's going to ship off and find his wealth. And then come back before he marries her.
And is immediately attacked by the Dread Pirate Roberts and killed, presumably.
Presumably.
And Buttercup cries and says she will never...
It was in the morning.
She will never love again. Mm-hmm. We then fast forward to she's riding a horse and she comes upon three weird dudes.
Well, no, what? We meet Prince Humperdinck before that.
Did we meet him?
Yeah, because...
I thought we didn't meet him until they were on the chase.
But we find out that she's marrying Prince Humperdinck before she gets captured, right? Otherwise, we wouldn't have...
I thought that was... That's fine. Okay. So then we meet Chris Sarandon, who plays Prince Humperdinck. So we now have Buttercup, Humperdinck. We have many absurd names.
Do you think that's where Engelbert Humperdinck got his name? Because that's a fascinating thing for me, but I'm getting too far off track. How do you change your name to Engelbert Humperdinck and still become a thriving pop star in the 70s?
I have no idea. But we meet Chris Sarandon, who plays Prince Humperdinck, who is then going to marry Princess Buttercup, and that's all we know at this point.
He's the prince in waiting because the king is getting old. He's kind of senile, as you find out.
He's about to die.
Right. He's no longer fit for ruling. He's about to die. And so he's going to marry. He gets. And Longland says he gets to choose his princess, his wife. And, of course, she made this vow she'd never love again. So she's not having it. But it's not her call. Chris Sarandon plays Prince Humperdinck. And I believe he was the former husband of Susan Sarandon, right?
Yeah, and most well-known to me as the lead vampire in Fright Night. What was his name in Fright Night?
Starts with a J, I thought.
I didn't write it.
I can't remember. But he was the main vampire. He's the one where the kids are trying to prove he's a vampire, and he keeps getting off.
Another fantastic character actor. And didn't we lose him?
Not a favorite film?
What's that?
Not a favorite film?
What, Fright Night?
Yeah.
Fright Night. One of my favorite films of all time. And probably
he was also in another one of your favorite films of all time. You know which one?
87. What's that?
Dog Day Afternoon.
Oh, yeah. Dog Day Afternoon with Dustin Hoffman.
Yep.
One of the best films of all time. See, I call that the best film, not my favorite. Dog Day Afternoon is a great film, though.
Gotcha.
Attica!
And we'll get to it later on, but there's another character actor in this film that was also in Dog Day Afternoon, but we'll get to that.
But Chris Sarandon is a character actor, a bona fide character. He's in all kinds of stuff. Absolutely. I stopped writing down what all the movies these guys were in because I figured we're at the 40-minute mark.
And
we're
right. only and at the first scene IMDb of the movie. IMDb is there for a reason, people.
We're at the first scene of the movie, so I stopped writing down all the connections here. But so then I guess she meets Humperdinck. She rides off on a horse, and she runs into three weird fellas. They call themselves Lost Circus Performers, looking for a town nearby. She says, there's no town within miles.
Good. Nobody will hear you scream.
Yeah, the little guy goes, good. Then no one will hear you scream. And they advance on her. And so we then meet Vizzini, Fezzik, and Inigo Montoya. Inigo Montoya left such a mark on my life from watching this movie as a kid that when I became a filmmaker, I named my main actor, the guy I used in every movie, one of my childhood friends, his name's Josh, I named him Joshitsuo Montoya as an homage to Inigo Montoya. I love that character so much. I love that character so much that I of course would walk around for the rest of my life and to this day saying, hello, my name is Inigo Montoya. You killed my father. Prepare to die. I love that character so much. He's played by Mandy Patinkin, who is
primarily a TV actor. But he's a huge character actor.
TV actor on television. He plays to this day. Currently, plays in a lot of the crime drama shows, like
Homicide,
the police shows,
and Criminal Minds is probably the most popular one. He was on for a while,
but he is so good in this movie. Mm-hmm. This is one of those characters that stays with you once you see him, once you hear his lines, once you get his personality, his passion. He stays with you forever. This character will never leave.
It's very different from what you typically see him do if you follow any of his TV work or other. Most of his film roles outside of this are fairly obscure things. But you see him a lot more on TV. There was a show called Dead Like Me, which I enjoyed. Mm-hmm. That was, again, very much his typical role. This is very much not like what you see him in TV.
And just as a character, let's just talk the writing or the story for a minute. It's very rare to get a character that's written as a supporting actor.
With this much heart.
Not only that much heart, but that much story.
Yeah.
The way this character's story arc plays out, he might as well be... You could tell this story from the perspective of Inigo Montoya and still have the Princess Bride.
That's an interesting idea.
You would still have the Princess Bride, wouldn't you?
Absolutely. Yeah. Here's the thing.
He's not the hero,
right.
But he's right there. He might as well be.
And he's kind of an anti-hero.
He's the anti-hero
of
this story.
But the thing is, here's a story about true love pulled asunder, and you have Wesley and Buttercup trying to reunite. And you think, that's where all the drama is. But honestly, there's more heartwarming, true emotional drama going on internally with Inigo Montoya throughout the film than there are between the two main characters.
He's in the revenge business.
When he finally gets his man.
Well, we'll get to it.
Yeah.
We'll get to that. So these three individuals played by... So Fezzik is the giant that they have. He's played by Andre the Giant, who is the famous pro wrestler that got body slammed by Hulk Hogan at WrestleMania 3 and became sort of he was the WWF's first major attraction.
He was from France originally.
Yeah.
And I forget the name of the condition, but he's got some sort of condition that makes you like a giant, basically. And it might be, casually called giantism. But basically he's huge. He's physically a massive man. I watched this great documentary put out by WWF or whoever puts out their little documentaries, but it was great about him. And it talks to, in the commentaries and special feature for Princess Bride, they talk about him, and anyone that worked with him, he's the sweetest man. Sweetest most gentleman you've ever met.
Nobody ever said a bad word.
Even though his hand could, like, hold your entire head.
Yeah, huge, huge human.
But the thing is what people don't realize is, and since we're talking about it now, I just thought I'd bring this up now. Despite his massive size, you think, oh, he's a giant, he's huge, he's strong. Very, relatively very weak guy. In fact, just prior to filming this, he underwent a major back surgery to where, and we'll get to it, the fight between him and Wesley, and even when he was holding or carrying Buttercup, he couldn't do that on his own. For Buttercup, she was on wires, and for there's this elaborate system of ramps that they shot him standing on during the fight scene with Wesley to where they could get the angles and make him look real, where he was never really supporting Wesley's weight. Huh. And he's not a big guy in comparison to Andre.
No, not a big. He's not a big guy, period.
But I mean, for such a big guy, that says a lot for his acting ability that he could pull this off.
Yeah.
And that he's so much fun to watch. I'm such a big Andre the Giant fan, and yeah, I still miss him.
He's great in this movie, too. He's just so... He's got so much wit and heart. Again, thanks to that script and to Rob Reiner's gentle direction, I think. Right. He was able to, in a film, an ensemble cast of some of the best character actors you're going to find.
Right.
He was able to hold his own.
And he really did. The only movie of any consequence I can see he was in outside of this was a movie called Trading Mom with Kim Basinger. And then he had a small uncredited role as Dagoth in Conan the Destroyer.
Okay.
Other than that, it's just all pro wrestling, which is a big part of acting, but it's totally different from being in a movie.
Different than
dialogue. And he had some great lines that he just nailed in this movie.
Oh, yeah.
Like,
yeah,
at one point, near the end, he gets horses for their getaway, and then he goes, "Fezzik, you did something right." And like that, Fezzik's response just nails. He goes, "Oh, I'm trying not to let it go to my head." But he's just, he's just so good in this movie.
And then our again, we have so if we have multiple heroes, we have multiple villains,
right?
And our first known villain to the film, to the story of the film, as we work through the film, is Vizzini, played by Wallace Shawn.
Oh, Wallace!
Wallace Shawn is in a fantastic film called My Dinner with Andre, which is one of the only movies that's shot in, it's a feature-length film shot in one location between two
limited shots,
two friends that are sitting at dinner having a conversation, one from the perspective of a science-minded person and one from an artistic philosophical minded person. And it's a feature-length film, and you never at any point feel bored because of the level of passion and intellect that these two are able to bring to this
directed
conversation.
Directed by French filmmaker Louis Malle, but it is in English for you that are scared of reading your movies. It is in English.
And a tidbit here that a lot of people don't know, but I've tried to clue in a lot over the years, is the location manager for My Dinner with Andre, which literally amounted to finding one place.
Cafe, yeah.
Was, do you know who that was? Trauma's Lloyd Kaufman.
Oh,
so okay. As we get further into our series here, we're going to be doing a film called The Toxic Avenger, directed by Lloyd Kaufman. Lloyd Kaufman did the... He was the location manager for Wallace Shawn's My Dinner with Andre, and we are so far away from Princess Bride now. Let's bring it back.
Bring it back.
This
more in tune. Wallace Shawn, you probably, if you have no idea what movie that is, it doesn't sound like your bag of tea. Wallace Shawn is probably best known for his voice. He voiced, and I can't remember the character from the Toy Story movies. He was one of the characters from all the Toy Story movies. It's escaping me now.
Yeah, I don't know.
I'll come back to it. But basically, he's done a lot of voiceover work for those and other movies and video games as well.
I'm looking it up right now.
And then I think it was called Animal Crackers. There was an obscure movie in the 80s where he played a character named Turtle that sticks out in my mind. But he kind of, I guess you kind of say he kind of reminds you of a little turtle. When you think about it, he's kind of a bald guy, kind of
very, very
sticks his head out, and kind of a nasally, kind of a nerdy little voice. But he plays Vicini, who's this like creepy, annoying little
Rex is the name of the character.
Yeah, yeah, he plays the T-Rex toy. Yeah, and he thinks he's super smart. He's egomaniacal, and he thinks himself a philosopher. who calls Aristotle, Socrates, and Plato, was it children?
Morons.
Morons, yes. So, do we want to go through the progression of how the Man in Black slash Wesley meets these characters?
Sure, yeah. So what ends up happening is they kidnap the princess, and, and because they are trying to, they're going to kill her on the other, the country across the river or sea.
Vecini's got this plan of starting a war between Florin, which is where the Princess Buttercup is from, and Gilder, which is across the sea. So he's kidnapping the princess from Florin and going to frame Gildan for her murder to get them to... Now, why he wants to do this, it's never really touched upon other than he's this egomaniacal little twerp.
It is later, but...
At this point.
At this point, we just think he wants to do it just to do it.
Right.
So, and his one-liner throughout this entire film is inconceivable. And our buddy Inigo Montoya, pretty early on, in fact,
calls him out
on it. And one of the best lines, again, this is a line I still use when applicable in my life. I quote this movie and say that word. I do not think it means what you think it means.
It's when they're standing on top of the cliff.
Yeah.
And they cut the rope and he doesn't die because the man in black
is
impossible.
So what ends up happening is they jump in a boat and they're trying to cross the sea. And Inigo Montoya casually is just watching behind them and sees a ship. And of course we get inconceivable from Wallace Shawn. Princess Buttercup ends up jumping out of the
boat,
one of the only offensive things she does.
Right.
The only time she ever takes it upon herself to try to do anything.
Other than that, she's just kind of eye candy.
She dives into the water and she's trying to escape.
That's when the shrieking begins.
And the what do they call them?
The shrieking
eels. The shrieking eels, which is ridiculous. There's so many awesome, ridiculous things in this movie. The shrieking eels is only the first.
And so Vecini, being the fearless leader that he is, commands one of his men to jump in, and Inigo Montoya says, "I don't swim," and Vecini and Fezzik says, "I just don't paddle."
Well, anyway, I don't want to get hung up on describing the entire film. So what ends up happening is they almost the ship that they with an unidentified person on almost catches them
closer,
but then Vecini looks over and says, "Oh, we're saved. It's the cliffs of insanity."
Dun, dun, dun.
So we have the shrieking eels, and now we have the cliffs of insanity, which is these names of these things in this movie are perfect. So they, long story short, they land.
And they think they've got it made because the whole reason he has the giant, Fezzik, is he's the only one strong enough to carry them all up this. That's just this rope that they have prefixed. He's going to climb the rope carrying all of them on this harness.
But very quickly, they see a man in black has gotten off the other boat, and he's scaling the rope even quicker.
Right.
And Wallace Shawn is, like, berating. There's, like, this great, like, Batman, mm-hmm. the 1960s Batman, where Batman and Robin would slowly climb up the walls from the Batarang. Well, they've got it shot like that, where Fezzik is slowly pulling him up the rope, and Wallace Shawn is just berating him the entire time. Like, the whole reason I hired you is because you're supposed to be the strongest man in the world, and yet this man is gaining on us. Inconceivable.
And I think Fezzik even comes back a little and is like, but he's not carrying three grown adults.
So, this, to me, The Princess Bride is like a series of scenes and characters. That's what makes this movie so great, is because these characters are so memorable. Mm-hmm. They have so many great witty lines, and so much absurd stuff happens to them. Mm-hmm. But this movie is a series of scenes. Mm-hmm. Whenever you say, remember the sword fighting scene from Princess Bride?
Yeah.
It gets so much time in this film. It's a mini movie in and of itself. It has an introduction, a conflict, a climax, and a resolution all its own. And so when we get to the top of the Cliffs of Insanity, Inigo Montoya, Fezzik, and Vizzini and the princess get up there first, and Vizzini basically says, yeah, stay here and kill him when he gets up to the top. Oh, they cut the rope, but he lands on the side of the cliff.
He grabs the side of the cliff, right.
And so they're just like, kill him when he gets up here, and the rest of them take off. And so Inigo Montoya
stays behind.
This is where we first get a real sense of who Inigo Montoya is and what makes him one of the greatest movie characters of all time, in my opinion. So he actually starts talking to the dude. He's like, could you hurry it up a bit?
And of course, Man in Black is like, you know, I mean, this isn't exactly the easiest thing I'm doing here. You know, you could maybe throw me a rope or something.
Well, like, there's well, a little banter back and forth. Yeah, he's right. Like, you know, can I help you? And he's like, no. And he's like, well, what if I give you my word as a Spaniard? And he's like,
I've known too many Spaniards
for that. He's like, and then he gets real serious. And he's like, I give you the word of the spirit of my father, right. River Montoya.
And immediately Wesley understands that. He's like, throw me a rope.
Throw me the rope. And so he climbs up. Inigo Montoya is literally pulling him.
Right.
Pulls him up, grabs him by the arm, gets him all the way up. So this man he's supposed to kill, he's literally like, all right, get up here.
Well, and then the Man in Black goes to pull his sword while he's catching his breath, and Inigo Montoya actually says, no, friend, catch your breath, please. Least I can do.
So he's like, oh, thank you very much. So this is already the most absurd sword fight in the history of sword fights. So they both take a seat on a rock, and Inigo Montoya casually says, oh, you don't have Neff's six fingers on your right hand, do you? And he's like, that's kind of a weird question to ask. And he holds up his hand. He's only got five. He's like, damn, I've been looking for the man who killed my father. He had six fingers on his right hand. And he goes into the backstory of how he watched this man slaughter his father when he was 8 or 9 years old. And then he tried. He picked up his father's sword, and he tried to slay the man, but all he got in return was
the cheek scar.
A sword scar on either cheek. And he's been in the revenge business.
For 20 years
looking for the murderer.
And he's starting to feel a little bit defeated.
There's a point also that's important to note here. He tells Vizzini, oh, I'm going to kill him with my left hand. Mm-hmm. And he's like, what? Why? And he's like, well, because it would be over too quickly. So the Man in Black is basically like, oh, you know, that's very touching. You know, you seem like a good fellow. And actually, they're I don't know. They have a little banter back and forth.
There's word banter as well as sword banter throughout this whole scene.
And then this one of my favorite lines of the film. There's a lot. This movie's quotable from beginning to end. Yeah. One of my favorites is, you seem like a decent fellow. And this is from Inigo Montoya. You seem like a decent fellow. I hate to kill you. And Wesley's retort is, you seem like a decent fellow too. I hate to die. It is so. And they go back and forth like this. And they literally have fencing dialogue. They go back and forth about, oh, you know the da-da-da technique.
Right.
And he's like, oh, yeah, that would be the end of this if I didn't know the da-da-da-da technique.
Right, exactly.
And so they sword fight all over the place. And Inigo Montoya says, you're very good. In fact, I have to admit, you're better than me. But I know something you don't know.
And what is that?
And Wesley says, what is that? And he says, I'm not left-handed. And dramatically throws his sword. And again, now the score this whole time under this is, like we said, really big. And it's you know, so when he switches hands, there's a big note when he switches hands.
Falling action as it goes.
Yeah, it's and Wesley says, oh, I'm not either. And he switches. So they've been sword fighting.
And it's the first time we see the Wesley / the Man in Black is always one step ahead of everyone.
Character in this movie. And so we've gone from, here, let me help you up. Go ahead and catch your breath. Let's have a conversation. You seem like a good fellow. I hate to kill you. You seem like a good fellow, too. I hate to die. They sword fight left-handed. Suddenly, the reveal is, I'm not left-handed. Let's fight. I'm going to fight you with my right
hand.
Neither am I. So now they go to right. They go.
And then we get to the climax. And then Inigo realizes he's outmatched. And then what does Wesley do?
Well, you tell me.
Well, Wesley then... he's like, just make it quick.
Yeah, so Inigo drops down and he says, just please make it quick. And literally Wesley is like, I would never do that.
I would assume destroy stained glass windows than to kill an artist such as yourself, and then knocks him out cold with the
Which is another fantastic quote. I would sooner smash a stained glass window than kill an artist such as yourself. And knocks him out
with the butt of his sword.
And then takes off.
Progresses on to the next scene.
So the next scene, he fights Fezzik, which, as Travis has already illustrated, doesn't last long. But it shows these quirky characters, because as Wesley's walking up, as the Man in Black is walking up, there's just a rock explodes next to his head. And the giant walks out, Fezzik walks out and says, I didn't have to miss, you know.
Yeah, before we get to that, we have to go back to another great line from Fezzik. Is when Vizzini was telling him what to do before Man in Black gets there, he tells him, I want you to kill him your way. And Fezzik says, well, what's my way? He says, you get that rock, hold it in your hand, you stay behind the boulder, and when he comes around the boulder, you throw the rock at his head and you kill him. He goes,
My way doesn't sound very sportsmanlike.
Yeah, my way doesn't sound very sportsmanlike.
So he deliberately misses to get Manny Black's attention, and literally the retort is, you know, I didn't have to do that. And Wesley goes, I'm glad you did.
I believe you.
Yeah, he says, I believe you.
So then Fezzik actually proposes that they put down their weapons and they fight like civilized men. And Man in Black's retort is, so you put down your rock and I put down my sword and we kill each other. Well, he says, we kill each other like civilized men.
Another fantastic line. Right.
And, so then they agree and they pursue to
But Wesley says, I'm not sure I'm quite...
Right.
Evenly, this is quite evenly matched.
Right.
And Fezzik's response is, it's not my fault. I'm bigger and stronger than anyone else.
I don't even exercise.
It's a fantastic line. So anyway, Wesley jumps on his back, chokes him out, and he says another classic line as he puts Fezzik to sleep. He says, sleep well and dream of large women.
I don't envy the headache you were going to wake up with, but for now, sleep well and dream of large women.
Dream of large women, which is a fantastic line. He then runs off to face Vizzini, the philosopher, the genius, and Wesley, and he's sitting at a rock, sitting on a rock with a big rock table in front of him and another rock, and so
he's holding Buttercup hostage at knife point.
Man in Black sits down and proposes a battle of wits.
Yes.
After Vizzini introduces himself by saying, "Have you heard of Aristotle? Have you heard of
Plato and Socrates? Yeah. Morons!"
And he says, "Well." Man, if you're intellect, I challenge you to
this
game of wits.
This dialogue from Wallace Shawn is just—it's so. He has some of the longest. I would say more than anyone in this movie, he has in this scene like a couple of the longest monologues as he's going through his crazy rationalization, because the man in black proposes, pour two glasses of wine. I have this poison, I'm going to put in one of the glasses, and you determine which one is poison, which one's not.
And Wallace Shawn then goes through out loud his reasoning why he can't choose. I surely couldn't choose the glass in front of you. I surely couldn't choose the glass in front of me. I surely couldn't choose the glass in front of you.
And at one point then Wesley, the man in black, says, you're stalling. He says, you would like to think that, wouldn't you?
And then he's like, well, then choose. And he says, okay, I'll choose right now.
What is that?
Look, what is that? And so Wesley turns his, man in black turns his back around. Wallace Shawn switches the drinks. Turns back around and says, are you ready? He says, yes.
He's grinning at me.
And so they both drink, and Wallace Shawn and
immediately goes,
you fell victim to one of the classic blunders, the most famous of which is never get involved in a land war in Asia, whatever that means. And then the second being whatever he says about never...
When death is on the line, never challenge a Sicilian.
Yeah.
And of course, that's when, it, as he's going through his diatribe, as he's doing his evil, you know, monologue, and then just freezes and falls over dead.
And keep in mind, Princess Buttercup has just sat quietly next to him
the whole time.
She's actually got
blindfold
on. Yeah. But so Man in Black pulls the blindfold off, and she goes,
Well, so this is the first time she's met the man in black, and her question is, how did you know which one had the
iocane
powder in it?
The iocane powder. And he says, simple. both cups had iocane powder. Spent the last couple of years building up a tolerance to it. I like that so much. Again, that stuck with me so much as a kid. Over on the other podcast, Reading to Strangers, this month we are doing a reading of a serialized reading, 20 minutes a week for 4 weeks, of one of my novellas called McCumans. Mm-hmm. One of the major plot points in the film is that the main character has been ingesting poison over the last month, so that when the big monster at the end eats him, he'll poison the monster and the monster will have to throw him back up. And that is literally an homage to The Princess Bride and to Vizzini's death scene from this movie. That's how much of an impact this film has had on me. I named a character in my films after it, and I took a plot point from it. I did an homage to a plot point from the movie. So
now, before we move on, this is an important thing to touch on at this key point, because at this point, this is the first time she meets the man in black. The man in black does not at this point immediately reveal who he is.
No, in fact, he's really, really, really mean to Princess Buttercup, as he's basically shit-testing her and basically saying, like, what would you know about love?
Is his payback for her...
Marrying,
even though she didn't want to, he doesn't realize that, marrying the prince.
So he's basically calling her out, being like, "Oh yeah, you think you know about love? Basically, he calls her out, and she says, "No, I've never loved another man. I loved once, and I'll never love again." And she's basically yelling at him, what's his name? Prince Humperdinck and his men sort of appear because they've been tracking him.
Yeah.
And they appear and Princess Buttercup basically says, what is the line? I don't remember the line she says, but she shoves...
down this hill and shoves, he rolls down the hill.
Shoves him down the hill and as he's rolling, he yells out, "As you, why don't you just die?" or something like that. Right. She says, and shoves him down this giant hill.
And he's rolling down the hill and he screams, yells, as you wish.
Which is what...
She immediately realizes who he is and goes running and then tumbling after him.
Because that's what he said to her every day when they were courting at the beginning.
Anytime she asked him to do something...
He always said, as
you wish. We're going way back to the beginning, but initially it was just her being a stuck-up royal bitch or whatever. And then he would always say, as you wish. And she gradually realized that when he says, as you wish, and this is said in the narration as Grandpa's reading it, as you wish meant, I love you. And then she realized that finally. We need to back up just for a second here, because we left out a character that we're introduced to during the tracking of them.
Yeah, we
alongside Prince Humperdinck is Count Rugen, which is played by Christopher Guest, which we find out is a central character later on.
Yeah. So when Wesley and Buttercup get to the bottom of the hill, she realizes her love has come back to her, and they enter into the Fire Swamp, which so now we have Screeching Eels, the Cliffs of Insanity, and Fire now the Swamp. Fire Swamp. So they walk into the Fire Swamp, and basically this is a walk and talk dialogue scene. It's again, it's one of those scenes in the movie where you say, remember the Fire Swamp scene from Princess Bride? It is a great scene that builds, has an introduction, a conflict, a climax, and a resolution all its own.
Reminds me of playing Dungeons and Dragons.
Basically, as they're walking through, fire shoots up out of
different geysers spots of fire, and it's always preceded by this kind of clicking sound. So that's how they finally get through it.
And the whole time they're walking and talking, Wesley is explaining where he's been for the last 5 years.
He did indeed get
captured by the Dread Pirate Roberts, and that he did indeed beg. He said, "Please," when the Dread Pirate Roberts set to kill him, and the Dread Pirate Roberts was so moved by his story of true love that he let him live. And he says these words to him. Again, this movie moved me so much as a kid. The guy, and he was a friend of mine, but the guy that I shared the locker with in high school, my senior year, we were locker neighbors. At the end of every day, I would say, "Good night, Wesley. Good work. Sleep well. I'll most likely kill you in the morning." And that's what the Dread Pirate Roberts would say to Wesley every night before he went to bed, until one day he took him into his cabin and basically revealed to him that the Dread Pirate Roberts has been retired for 15 years and that they just keep passing it down. And so they wear a mask so that no one knows who the real Dread Pirate Roberts is. So he is the Dread Pirate Roberts.
And at some point, I remember a service from someone asked him, "Why Dread Pirate Roberts?" He said, "Well, nobody would ever fear Dread Pirate Wesley."
Yeah, exactly. So they make their way through the Fire Swamp. A lot of crazy stuff happens. They get to a certain point, though, where Wesley says, "Well, this isn't that bad. You know, there are three perils of the Fire Swamp. We've already been able to get past the fire geysers. We've already done something else."
No, because before we get to that explanation, it's the second peril, which are the... I forget what they call it, but it's the quicksand. Remember, she falls in the quicksand.
She does fall in the quicksand.
Because we don't run into the next one until he pulls her out.
So, yeah, she falls, she steps, she just makes
a
step.
He cuts a vine, dives in after her, and pulls her out.
Pulls her out.
And we're introduced to this third peril while they're in there before he pulls her back out.
But he doesn't see him. And we see these things called rodents of extraordinary...
rodents of unusual size.
Of unusual size. the RUSs.
Yeah.
Is what she calls him. So he pulls her out dramatically, and he says, "You know, this wasn't that bad. We escaped the fire geysers, the quicksand."
And she says, "What about the rodents of the usual size?
What about the RUSs?"
And his response is, "Oh, they don't exist."
He says, "Oh, I don't believe they exist."
And
literally pitch perfect immediately, this giant rubber suited, this giant
rodent of unusual size,
which is a man in a rubber suit, smashes into him, and there's this epic fight, and this thing is chewing on him, and he's stabbing. It and he ends up having to roll it into the fire, and Princess Buttercup is, I guess, for the second time in the film, trying to hit it with a stick, trying to do something offensive for the second and probably last time in the film. But he does end up catching the thing on fire and then stabbing it and killing it, and he's barely still alive, barely, and they limp out of the forest only to be captured by Prince Humperdinck
and his
party. Yeah, so. Have we been introduced to everybody at this point? Yeah.
Yeah, of recurring importance, yes.
Yeah, so We keep moving through. So he tells them, right? He takes Buttercup, basically says, "Don't kill him. Take him back to his ship, and I'll come back and I'll marry you. I promise I'll marry you if you let him live."
And of course, Prince Humperdinck, being a two-faced bastard, he says, he agrees to this.
Sure, we'll let him live. You know, send him off and come with me. And I think it's at that point or very soon after he reveals that he actually hired Vizzini to kill Buttercup so that he could start a war with.
He's going to kill.
He has to make
Buttercup
a new plan.
After they get
he
married.
Has to make a new plan.
Right.
He had Vizzini kidnap her to kill her to start a war with Gilder.
But that, of course, failed. Yeah,
so Gilder, since that failed, he decided, well, I'm going to marry her anyway, and then I'm going to strangle her to death on her wedding night and blame it on Gilder.
Right.
So he's still got this. So we realize at this point, oh, shit, Prince Humperdinck is the real big bad of this movie. He's the real villain. And he sentences Wesley. So he tells her that, oh, yeah, we'll send him back to the ship, but he actually sends him
to the machine.
Well, but what is that the place called?
Oh, it's the Pit of Despair.
The Pit of Despair. So we have the Fire Swamp, the Cliffs of Insanity, the Shrieking Eels, and the
Rodents of Unusual Size.
The Rodents of Unusual Size.
The Pit of Despair.
Pit of Despair. So, long story short, it's this hidden torture chamber in the base of a tree, and there's a weird little
albino
guy. In there, but that's what actually Christopher Guest's Count Rugen's actual job is he's the torturer.
He created this torture device called the Machine, which is his big project. He's like a really scientific, keeping records, tracking, and he's very, very serious and scientific about this. And basically what it is it's this contraption of wheels and pulleys, and it's got these suction cups. It essentially sucks life out of its victim.
And he can set this thing to 1 year.
To different levels. One to 50, basically.
Level one is I take 1 year, I suck 1 year of your life. Level two is 2 years, whatever. He says, maybe one day we'll get to 5.
Right.
But he's basically going to sit here and torture this guy. Right. And he's like a weirdo. He keeps asking him, like, please, this is for posterity. So and basically Wesley's in a world of hurt. Yeah. Well, at the same time, since the marriage is about to happen, Humperdinck basically says, clear out the thief den, and we need to set them in front of the... He wants the whole kingdom to be guarded so he can marry this chick and kill her. And at this point, since they've failed, Inigo Montoya and Fezzik are off.
He's basically shit-faced drunk out in front, where it all started, where Vizzini hired him. So he talks about, you know, we agreed, we'll meet back. If anything goes wrong, we'll meet back where we started. I'm here where we started. He's shit-faced drunk. He's worthless. And that's when Fezzik finds him.
And then we cut back to basically Humperdinck confronts
Buttercup.
Buttercup.
She calls his bluff.
Buttercup basically calls his bluff and says, I'll kill myself.
Well, she berates him. Yeah. She ends up calling him a Weasley coward.
Yeah.
Just totally berates him to the point where he loses his cool.
He gets so mad.
Locks her up.
He locks her up and then runs down.
Runs down to the Pit of Despair.
Pit of Despair and cranks
all the way up to 50.
Cranks it all the way up to 50.
Or up to 11.
and then Fezzik and Montoya.
And of course, Calhoun is like, not 50.
Yeah. He can't even believe it. He's the most sadistic dude in the kingdom, and he can't believe it.
Yeah, so Wesley lets out this massive wail.
This horrific shriek, which sounds like a combination of something they recorded plus the... plus what is that?
The Shrieking Eels?
What is the shriek that they always use in... it has a name. They use in all the Wilhelm scream.
Yeah.
It seems like a combination of the Wilhelm scream plus something they recorded like together. But it's like,
and then Inigo, despite
Inigo
being
can hear
completely
him.
Inebriated, hears him. He says, "Fezzik, that's the man in black. How do you know? That's the scream of a man who's suffering the ultimate pain, and the man in black, his true love is about to marry another. Who else would be suffering the ultimate pain right now?"
And he says, "That's the sound I made when my father was killed."
Right.
So again, we have another connection between these two.
So they're like, "We have to go find them."
So they do. They go. Well, Fezzik has this nice little montage of like dunking Montoya's head in like cold water, hot water, cold water, hot water, slapping him in the face. He's like, let's go. So they run around. They run into the albino. They knock out the albino, and then this really
accidentally
cool scene of Montoya basically calling on the spirit of his father through his sword and says, "Father, please guide me." And he walks around with his eyes closed and he walks in circles, and then his sword hits the tree where the pit of despair is hidden under, and he basically looks at it and he's like, "Ah," defeated, because he's just
tree.
So he leans on it, but when he leans on it, he flips the
secret knot that opens the door. Real quick pause on this. This is another example of how Mark Knopfler's music is key to this movie, because the piece he made for this scene specifically is amazing for the scene. There's a specific, I forget the name of it, has to do with the scene, but there's a piece he created specifically for the scene that was excellent.
So they go down, and the whole score is, that's what we've been saying, this whole thing, like, it's literally, he watched the cut of the film and built the music for every movement, every shot, every feeling, and for some films that would be too much, but for this, it helps that fantasy feeling of this storybook adventure that we're watching. So they grab Wesley, who's dead, and they take his dead body to...
Well, and Nico says, "We need a miracle," and so he's going to take it to... Who else but Miracle Max?
Miracle Max, played by Billy Crystal. And
oh my God, this is possibly one of the best scenes on the whole movie.
This is really reminiscent of that scene. Is it also played by Billy Crystal from The NeverEnding Story? There's a couple in The NeverEnding Story.
You know, it might be. Keep talking.
So they basically take him to Miracle Max, and Miracle Max says, "Well, he's dead."
It's great. And
it's this back and forth between them. You might remember the dialogue better than I do. I don't remember it.
Well, basically, he goes on about how he used to work for the king, but then when his son took power, he fired him.
Well, that's once they get him inside. So once they get him inside, he uses an air blower. Says,
"Besides, if I'm such a failure, I might kill him. Well, he's already dead. Oh, well, bring him in. I'll see
what I do." Yeah, that's what I was forgetting. Yeah. It was like, "Oh, well, you know, the king fired me because I'm a failure, so I might kill him." And they're like, "Well, he's already clearly dead." He's like, "Bring him inside." So he pumps him full of air.
With a bellow.
And he basically says...
He asks him, "What do you have worth living for?"
Because he puts his head on his... Right. He puts his ear against his chest. And he's mostly dead. Not all the way dead, though. Mostly dead. And so he says, "What do you have to live for?" And he pushes his stomach in, and he says, "True love."
But in a way, he's like...
And so Inigo's like, "There, he said it, true love. That's what he has to live for." And,
oh, you'd love it if he said that. It's the greatest thing in the world. But it's clear he said to blame, which means to cheat. And he probably owed this guy money.
You guys were playing cards or something.
And then that's when Valerie, his wife, played by Carole King, comes running out and says, "Liar! Liar!" And he's like, "Shut up, witch."
He calls her a witch.
"Shut up, witch. I'm your wife, but based on what you just said, I don't even want to be united anymore."
So basically calling him a coward.
And the banter between him and his wife is priceless.
Calling him a coward, basically saying, you know, he doesn't want to help because he's afraid of what Prince Humperdinck would do.
She says, "Ever since he got fired, his confidence has been shattered."
So Inigo Montoya basically tells him, like, "Well, this guy's going to kill Prince Humperdinck. That's who his true love is Princess Buttercup, who's going to have to marry him." He's like, well, in that case. And they quickly make him a magic pill, and they basically say, you know, "Don't take it for 15 minutes and don't swim for an hour." And they send him on their way. So they go to the castle, and Inigo Montoya and Fezzik and Wesley, who's still dead,
don't forget the last little bit of dialogue.
What
do you think? Valerie says, "What do you think? They have a chance?" She goes, "It would take a miracle."
Yeah,
like, he says, "Have fun storming the castle." Yeah. And she says, "Do you think they have a chance?"
The castle.
And he replies, "It would take a miracle."
Which, again, these scenes are so well done, and they're their own little movies, like where you can literally say, "Remember the Miracle Max scene?" And there's so many quotable things from that scene. And so they basically prop up Wesley and look down.
He's
like,
floppy. He's like a marionette.
No, he's dead. He's dead.
Well, yeah, they haven't given him the pill yet.
They're basically like, "Oh, man, they said there were 30 men. There's actually 60. Like, there's no way we can beat him. I'll give him the pill." You know, Andre the Giant is basically like, you know, "Give him the pill anyway. We'll see how long it takes to work." So they pop the pill in his mouth, and his eyes immediately open. "Well, that didn't take long," is what Fezzik says. And basically, so Wesley, for the next most of the film, spends the film as like this. He's unable to move any part of his body. He's able just to his talk. Head. He's able to talk. We can't even move his head at first. Like this, they have to turn his head for him.
Well, he wakes up and says, "Who am I? Where am I? Are you friend or foe?"
Yeah, he's completely disoriented.
Why can't I move my arms?
They explain to him like, "Well, do we have a?" They explain to him what's going on. They explain to him.
Well, if he goes into that quote, what he first responds is, "Well, you've been mostly dead all day.
You've been mostly dead all day." So I get it. And he's like, "Yeah. Well, do we have a cart?" And he's like, "Well, yeah, we have a cart." He's like, "Well, you because he's like." The way he words it is like,
I wish we had a wheelbarrow. And Inigo was like, what are we to do with the wheelbarrow that had the albino? And Fezzik's response was something to the effect of, I think it's on the albino. I think the albino's underneath it.
Yeah. So they basically, Wesley throws this, and then he's like, well, if I had a cloak of something.
Which Fezzik's pulls one out. Pulls one right out. Where'd you get that? Well, Max, it looks so good on me, Max said I could keep it.
So suddenly they have this cloak, they have this
wheelbarrow. Everything's coming together.
They basically make this, they decide that they're going to put Andre the Giant Fezzik in this cloak and set him on fire, call him the Dread Pirate Roberts. Mm-hmm. That's the most feared pirate in the land. So all the everyone scatters. They're able to get into the castle, and now we have some showdowns. Well, the whole time this is interspersed with the marriage
dialogue. The main security guy who has the only key, and they're like, "Give me a key." He's like, "I don't know what key you're talking about." And then Inigo just says, "Fezzik, tear off his arms." Oh, you mean this key?
Oh, you mean this key? But intercut throughout this is the marriage scene. Right. Where Chris Sarandon is trying to hurry this along because this clergyman
played by Peter Cook
has a speech impediment. So he's saying, "Marriage,
true love,
between a man and a woman."
It reminds me a little of the wedding scene from Spaceballs.
Yeah. So he's again. This is very Mel Brooks. Mm-hmm. Yep. When I say Jewy, I mean it in the most
loving
possible way. This is such a Mel Brooks style movie, except just dialed back one little degree. So, Chris Sarandon's Prince Humperdinck is basically like, "Hurry this along. Just say,
man and wife. Yeah, just say
man and wife. Man and wife." And so they take off, and he locks her back up because he can hear that there's a fight going on outside. He wants to get this marriage over with so he can kill her and blame it. So his plan can work. And so they storm the castle. And I forget what happens to Fezzik during all this, but Inigo runs off by himself.
Inigo runs off.
Oh, yeah, and Fezzik still has Wesley.
And they face to face. Fezzik's still dragging Wesley along,
yeah.
And then they run into Khat Ruggan.
Yeah.
And then Khat Ruggan, here's
a plot point that I don't understand. Maybe you remember how this actually comes together. But at a certain point, when Buttercup goes off with Humperdinck, and Wesley's left with Count Ruggan, he sees that Count Ruggan has the six fingers on his right hand. But Wesley then dies, never tells anybody that he saw the six-fingered man, Inigo and Fezzik somehow know that. When they get there, they know... Montoya knows who he's looking for. He knows that Ruggan has the six fingers.
Right. I'm trying to remember what. I think at some point, just briefly, Wesley may have said something, but I don't remember. But it's a good point. It's worth looking back into.
Because as soon as it happened, I was like, wait a minute, Wesley's been dead this whole time. And I don't think that dialogue takes place after they wake him up.
Somehow it's conveyed. I just don't remember.
There's some way.
They had to, because it's too big of a hole.
Inigo knows that he's after Ruggan, and so they spot him. And Inigo Montoya goes running off after him.
Well, because they're about to face off, and then Count Ruggan turns tail and runs away like a coward that he is. And so then Inigo, completely just filled with rage, chases after him. And then he escapes through a door, and the door locks, and he's screaming for Fezzik, and he can't get through.
And he's like,
he's getting away, Fezzik, please come here. And Fezzik has to lean him up with his arms in this, like, standing, like, knight's armor statue. And
leans Wesley up.
And goes up, and then stops Inigo, and has one punch, knocks down the door.
Yeah, so Inigo is literally bracing off against the wall and slamming his body into the door as hard as he can over and over again. And Fezzik just walks up and pushes it over instantly.
So Inigo runs off to follow him.
So this is this brilliant...
Yep.
Brilliant scene. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's played so well. It could have easily just been...
In a heat of passion and emotion, he's finally going to get his revenge. He runs around the corner, and he's met with what?
He gets stabbed right in the stomach.
Well, Khat Ruggan's waiting, and he throws a dagger He throws a dagger at him as he comes around the corner, catches him off guard instead of finding him like a man. And immediately, from the pain and just the shock, and at that moment, and he was like, oh, I failed your father. And he kind of stumbles back and leans against the wall, and then Count Rugen approaches, and he goes in his evil monologue.
And he ends up stabbing...
in each shoulder.
Ends up stabbing Inigo, and Inigo is just all bloody, all fucked up, but that revenge rage...
And the reason he stabs him in the shoulder is Inigo's not quite done yet. He's going to kill him, but when he lunges, Inigo uses his sword to deflect into each of his shoulders instead of into his heart.
Right.
And then it's at that point, Inigo starts chanting what?
Yeah, he says, my name is Inigo Montoya, you killed my father, prepare to die.
And over
he
just and chants over. It over and over and over. And it starts and freaking Count Rugen shit
out. Stop saying that.
And catches him off guard. And so then he starts fighting back. Anytime Count Rugen flails his sword, and Inigo Montoya's true skill comes out, just swats it off like a fly, and then gives him pays him back with the scars on his cheeks.
Stabs
in the shoulders.
And then he starts telling him, now tell me you'll give me money. I'll give you anything.
And he does. I'll give you power. Like a little
I'll give you everything.
Right.
And he stabs him right in the stomach. And what does he say?
You have to tell me. I don't remember that
he
part.
He says it one more time. My name is Emilio Montoya, and you killed my father, you son of a bitch.
Right.
And stabs him in the stomach and kills him. And man, if that's not one of the most satisfying revenge scenes in any film of all time. And this is a goofy fantasy.
It has its moments, though. That's why it's so heartwarming. It's not just comedy. It has its satisfying moments.
So at this point, Fezzik has dragged Wesley into Buttercup's room and laid him down on the bed. And this is another really intense scene where basically Wesley is completely defenseless at this point.
Buttercup's in there with him. And Buttercup comes in, actually, and she's going through her little monologue about how she's going to kill herself, she's going to stab herself, and then yet another great line of dialogue from Wesley. He says, there's a shortage of perfect breasts in the world.
Yeah,
they'd be ashamed to damage
yeah, she doesn't
hers.
Realize he's in there.
Right. So she turns, sees him.
There's
she,
a shortage
she jumps
of perfect breasts in the world. It will be a shame to lose yours.
Damage yours. So she jumps on him, ready to jump his bone. He's like, and she's like, now of all times, why aren't you kissing me or anything? And he's basically like, baby, my whole body's limp. he's laying there. He can't.
Been mostly dead all day.
Right. And so she's like, oh my God. And then that's when
Humperdinck comes crashing through the door, and he's basically got Wesley dead to rights.
Right. And he's like, I can kill him right now.
But Wesley starts talking
too smart
some
for
shit.
Right.
He starts talking some major shit. He starts calling him, what does he say? He's got some lines here.
Well, and what he does is he basically, he tells him, what he's going to do to him. He's like, well, yeah, that's fine. I'm going to cut off your arm, your feet, cut off your...
Oh, we're not going to fight to the death. We're going to fight to the pain. He says,
to
the pain. He says,
I'm not familiar with that term.
Yeah, he says, I'll use small words so that you'll be sure to understand, you warthog-faced buffoon. And he's basically attacking Humperdinck with words here because he can't move his body at all. And he says, I'm going to cut you off. I'm going to cut you out.
He goes step by step. What he's going to do, he's going to cut off your feet at your ankles, going to cut off your hands at your wrists. He's going to cut off your nose.
Cut off your nose. And he goes, yeah.
And then you're going to cut off my ears. And he goes, wrong. And you're going to keep your ears. Because I want you to hear every shriek of every child and woman as they walk by going, oh my God, what is that thing?
And it basically freaks Humperdinck out to the point that he's ready to...
He's questioning himself.
He's ready to run.
But he's going to kill him
But he does say, you're just... basically says, you're bluffing. You can't even hold your sword. And Wesley basically says, that may be the truth.
Or maybe not.
And he stands up.
And lifts his sword and points it at him.
And he says, drop your sword.
And
and
the character
No, it cuts to Chris Sarandon. He's standing there like,
you see the expression.
And then he drops the sword. He's like, sit down. And he goes
over. Scurries up there like a school kid.
And sits down like he's in trouble.
And Buttercup ties him up. Right as she's got him tied up and he can't do anything about it, that's when he gives and all his strength is gone and he just kind of starts to
falls
collapse.
Over
and
Chris Sarandon goes, I knew you were bluffing. And so from there, we're almost done. We're almost out the door at this point.
Because, at this point, then Inigo catches up, and then And then, of course, that's when
Fezzik is outside with the horses. Yeah, with
the horses, and he says, hey, I found these horses. And Inigo says, hey, you did something right. Fezzik's like, I won't let it go to my head. And then Buttercup jumps out first.
Buttercup jumps out, and then right as Inigo's getting ready to jump out, they have a little conversation where Inigo says, I've been in the revenge business for so long, I don't know what else to do. And Wesley looks at him and goes, have you ever thought of piracy?
You make a great Dead Robert.
And whenever I say that the arc of that character, Inigo Montoya, is just as important, so we've gone from a character that's been trying to enact revenge his whole life, his everything has been built around this. He finally does it, and now he's saying, well, I've done it. What else am I going to do with my life? Now he's going to go off. Now he's going to go off and be the Dread Pirate Roberts, and he's going to make. And just us knowing his character and his disposition, his personality, his mastery of sword fighting, isn't he going to make the best Dread Pirate Roberts?
Which would have been a really cool follow up movie.
That's what I mean. This movie could have been from the perspective of Inigo Montoya and still been just as good.
That's true.
So they end up riding off into the sunset together, basically.
And then you have the kiss, the two lovers reunited kiss,
and then it abruptly stops. As soon as they start kissing, it abruptly stops, and Grandpa says,
closes the book. Yeah, that's it. And he says, well, what'd you stop?
Fred Savage is the grandson. He's like, whoa, and why'd you stop right there?
That's just more kissing, you know, one thing. He's like, no, it's all right. I think it'll be okay. So he reads a little, and it's not much. It's just, there've been five most passionate kisses throughout the history of time, and just rival them all. And then the film ends.
And basically, so you get that book in with the grandfather and the grandson.
And the grandson says, you know, maybe you can come back and read it to me again tomorrow.
Yeah.
Which is so perfect and perfectly meta, because that's how this film is. It's like, man, I could totally go back and watch this movie again tomorrow.
There's just so many fantastic lines in this movie. I think when we were setting this up, I said that, you know, this is the type of film that you can quote basically the entire script from front to back. And we did a lot. One of them that I like a lot is, death cannot stop true love. All it can do is delay it for a while.
Mm-hmm. Another one that came from Vicini from Wesley to Buttercup is life is pain. I think this is before she realized who Man in Black was. He says, life is pain, Highness. Anyone who says differently is selling something.
It's selling something. That's a fantastic line. Another line from Miracle Max is, he says, he's mostly dead. With all dead, there's usually only one thing you could do. Go through his clothes and look for loose change.
Right. Another one from Miracle Max is, if you rush a miracle man, you get a rotten miracle. but there's so much great dialogue that is not as quotable because it takes two to three people, because it's banter. So much of the great dialogue in this movie is banter, and it's not as easy to just freely quote on the fly, but it goes to a great distance in making this film so memorable and so enjoyable. Very dialogue is just amazing in this movie.
Yeah, there's actually a Pinterest that exists called 1,000 Princess Bride Quotes. Now, I don't think there are quite 1,000 different quotes.
Maybe you quote everything in the movie, but
that's the kind of quotability this movie has.
Yeah.
Why it's one of my favorite movies, one of my favorite films of all time.
But why I think the only movie I've ever loved on this level that's been more quotable would have to be Monty Python the Holy Grail. I mean, but it's on that level.
So that's why I think this is a perfect film. I don't think there's any moment here where this film is bad. And it has such a great payoff for every character. Has a fantastic payoff. It's just such a solid movie.
And you've kind of mentioned it before, even though it's not a Mel Brooks film, it ranks up there with Mel Brooks' best films.
Absolutely. And again, one of the things that I think does these 80s movies, makes them so good, movies like RoboCop and this movie, these late 80s, early 90s movies, is because Hollywood relied so much on character actors. Mm-hmm. Every single one of these actors is a character actor in The Andre the Giant. But you know what I'm saying? It's like, that was a certain era. Mm-hmm. The movies aren't made like that.
No.
When the hell was the last movie that was made with nothing but character actors?
You had a few things come up in the 90s, but recently it's just everything started. It's like
Tarantino kind of was the
well, he tries to bring it back with his movies.
Yeah.
He has the same, or I don't want to say same necessarily, but a very similar passion that we do for movies, in that he treasures the things of the past that worked so well that you don't see in movies today. He tries to bring it back, both to pay homage, but then to help reintroduce it to new generations that wouldn't otherwise give him the time of day.
Yeah. So I think that's one of the reasons we love these so much and why we'll end up doing so many late 80s, early 90s movies over the course of the next couple of years as we work through this list of 100 and then make a list of 100 more to do for you guys. But as always, if you like what you if you like what you hear, go ahead and contact us and let us know movies you would like to hear us do. Do you have more about it?
Well, I had there's one thing I wanted to fit in. We talked about this briefly off podcast. But something I want to kind of try
doing the Fred Decker episode.
If you guys remember from the 90s, there was a craze that swept through the youths called 6 Degrees of Kevin Bacon, where you try to connect Kevin Bacon to someone. Someone just names someone. You try to connect them to Kevin Bacon.
Because Kevin Bacon was in so many movies.
Right, he's been in so many
movies. He's literally
connected
to everyone by less than 6 degrees.
So we decided, since we have such a passion with Fred Decker, and he's only directed 3 films.
He only did 3 movies, but we can.
So I'm challenging myself for every movie, every episode, that movie, I'm going to try and connect it in 6 degrees or less to Fred Decker.
Fred Decker.
So we're starting with The Princess Bride, and I managed to connect The Princess Bride to Fred Decker in 4 degrees.
Dope.
The Princess Bride stars Robin Wright as Princess Buttercup, the Princess Bride. Robin Wright starred alongside Robert Downey Jr. in The Singing Detective. Robert Downey Jr. starred in Kiss Kiss Bang Bang, which was written by Shane Black.
There you go.
Who co-wrote The Monster Squad with Fred Decker.
There you go.
So there we go.
Always going to come back to Shane Black, by the way. Shane Black's prolific.
He is a bonus, but there's going to be. I guarantee there's going to be times I can't use him.
You think?
Yeah, there'll be ways.
We'll see. All right. So anyway, gang, if there's something you want to hear us talk about, geek out on longer than the runtime of the damn movies themselves. Although this one,
we do it again?
This one runs a little short. No, we're only an hour and 30 minutes.
We can still fix that.
No, I'm good. I'm done for the day. So what do we have on deck for next week?
Oh, you know what?
It's a good one, I know.
Top of my head.
I want to say it's Over the Top.
Stall for me.
I want to say it's Over the Top. We have I don't want to give away what we have coming. But
it'll be a surprise. It'll be good, as always.
This is how this operation is run, gang. We don't even know what the hell our next movie is.
Winging it.
One week to the next. This one was so much fun to do. I've seen this movie 10,000 times, and there's always something new every time, and it still makes me laugh out loud. Like the comedy timing of The Princess Bride, like the acting and the editing and the directing are so solid that that I end up still all these years later laughing out loud at these stupid lines.
Yeah, this is one of those movies I can watch every day and never get tired of it.
Yeah, for sure. Desert Island movie for sure. So what's the next one?
I don't know. They'll find out when
we'll see you guys next week. And do you have anything else to add?
No. Just keep watching.
Keep watching.
All music heard on the Watching with Strangers podcast, courtesy of Kevin MacLeod at Incompetech.com. Licensed under Creative Commons by Attribution 3.0. http://creativecommons.org/license/by/3.0/